SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. We'll call it hour two. It's close enough to the top of the hour, and it is an absolute pleasure for me to get Mark Reed on the show. I couldn't, over the years going back to the late 80s, we couldn't have Mark on then. The show didn't exist. SiriusXM didn't exist. So we couldn't talk about Mr. Nickerson then, and my buddy and I, we were following around Easy Goer, but the horse that I came to like even more during that era was Mark's wonderful sprinter. And right now he's back training, and you know, you seemed like you got back into it, Mark, kind of just, you know, keep a little busy, but suddenly you got a stakes filly on your hands. Please flatter me. A winner last week at Penn National in the Blue Mountain Juvenile. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Boy, talking about Mr. Nickerson really put some age on me. I didn't realize I was quite that old. You're talking about the 80s before your show. That's a frightening thought for an old man.
Well, you know what? I'm looking at this picture. This is a Coghlanese shot of him being ponied at Belmont. And you shouldn't feel bad. You should see Angel. You look pretty much the same. Angel's put on a couple of years.
Well, that's the beauty of never looking really good when I was young. You know, everybody else is kind of caught up and passed me. I like that a lot. That's the good thing about going bald at 25.
That's great. I love it. Well, you know, when he was, my God, I know it's tough in one sense to talk about him, given the really unfair way things turn. But he, is it fair to say that he was like an imperial hint, basically? He was not a big horse, but boy, was he a hard trier, and the True North and the Boojum and the Bold Ruler. I mean, he was just a hard hitter.
He was a tough horse. You know, I took him up there. He won more stakes that year. He passed away than any other, more graded stakes than any other horse. And he was just the real deal. He came, brought his A game every time he went over, and you know, had gas out of there, and you had to run him down if you were going to win the race. he was a monster.
Exactly. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Earned $600,000 and was gonna stand stud, right? You had a stud deal lined up.
We had already finished the stud deal. He was leaving 3 days after the Breeders' Cup. He was going down to the Vinery in Lexington, and we were very excited and looking forward to that, but it wasn't to be. It was a bad day, particularly for me. I had walked back to the barn after we lost him, and I had turned and was walking up the shed row, and I looked in. Phil Gleave shared a barn with me. I looked in his tack room, and they had the Biocoa Go for Juan race on. And I saw that. I just got in my car and came home. I watched the classic that I'm bridled won from my home. It was a tough, tough day.
It's one of the darkest days in racing history, and people recall the distaff, but the day started badly with Mr. Nickerson's cardiac event, and shaker knit fell over
him and was fatally injured as well. It was a brutal day, and my jockey, you know, Chris Antley, broke his shoulder and missed considerable time. It just was an awful, awful day. Worst I've ever had in racing.
But the highs with him were extensive. Won 10 times in 25 starts, earned $600,000, and was just so likable. You know, a few years later, about another 5 years later or so, you kind of turned your attention to Bloodstock, Mark, and then all of a sudden you started to see a name, see your name and show up, a couple of starters here, a couple starters there. Well, now you're back almost in full swing.
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed the Bloodstock immensely. I've had considerable success there with the likes of Medaglia d'Oro, Peace Rules. And just recently, a horse I bought won the Breeders' Cup, Miles City of Light. So I enjoy that, and it was great. But I'll tell you the truth, Steve, it moved too slow. You know, you do three or four or five deals in a year. The money was good, but too much time sitting around twiddling my thumbs. And I thought, you know, if I could have a little more to do, I might last a little longer in this world. So, you know, I contacted a couple of friends of mine and got a couple of horses, and then a couple turned into, you know, 15, and now it's turned into 30.
And
we're back swinging pretty good at it, frankly.
Well, and before we talk about this filly, about Please Flatter Me, because it really, you know, for those that missed it last week at Penn National, I mean, this is a serious filly and earned a bit, you know, a nice fig, and is clearly, you know, even if she keeps to her own kind, Pennsylvania breds, she's got a serious future. What has changed? What's changed for the better? What's changed for the worse from 10 years ago plus?
Well, it's only been the better for me. I don't feel the same kind of pressure as a young guy, you know, growing up. You know, everything had to be the next race. It was life and death. And, you know, who could I claim? Who could I buy, you know, to keep your name going and keep the string moving? I don't feel that same sort of pressure anymore. I sneak away for a day or two, play with my grandkids. I do some other things, and I just do this now because I enjoy it. I'm fortunate in that I have a great owner right now, a guy named Dan Ryan from the famous Marilyn Ryan family, who used to be with Woody Stevens and had champions, and he understands the game. And he and I have a great rapport, so I don't feel the same. You know, I work probably harder, but there's less pressure. It's kind of an odd thing. I don't feel the same intenseness I felt when I was coming up through the ranks.
Expand on that, because of course, you know, in the interim, I've had Butchie on, you know, many times. Your brother Butch, and
right.
I don't know if I've ever. I probably did at some point, maybe with Alex. At some point, asked him about the two of you growing up and getting on the racetrack and how that even all came to be.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. We're not racetrack or farmer people. We're not, you know, we just grew up in a where most of the kids in the 50s and 60s grew up in a little community in South Jersey. The one thing we had going for us was our father was a racetracker. You know, talks about working at the plant when he was a young guy, and the guys would give him money, run up to Garden State on lunch hour and place all the guys' bets. And he took me to the races when I was a sophomore in college. I had mononucleosis one summer, and I was just laying around. I couldn't work my summer job. And after I laid there about a month, he said, come here, I'm going to take you somewhere. It's going to change your life. And he took me to Atlantic City in the summer. And I immediately fell in love. Not so much the gambling. I loved these. I had an athletic background. And I loved these, you know, watching these horses being trained. And you know, the idea of training one that, you know, I could develop to beat the next guy. I love the competitive nature of the sport. So it was a natural for me I was in industrial sales right out of college, and one day I wrote some letters to some trainers. Dickie Dutrow hired me in Maryland, Richard Dutrow Sr., and the first year I was with him, he set a world record for number of winners, and that was it for me. I cast the rest of the world aside and just went to the racetrack. And then Butch kind of followed me in. He had gotten out and was working at the casinos, and one day he said, "What about this racetrack stuff?" I said, "Vanna, man, you'll never want to do anything else." So he followed me in, and we've kind of built it from there.
And, of course, you know, you both have been, you know, successful, you know, very quickly and building a clientele and then winning races at the highest level. And you know, certainly, you know, Maximus Mischief for Butchie on Saturday and the Remsen coming up, and, you know, a horse that seems like it's got the kind of trajectory toward you know, Derby Trail. And for you, talk about the filly that is clearly, you know, got some upside, and now 2 for 2. Please flatter me, a Munnings filly that really I thought was terrific in the Blue Mountain.
Yeah, very exciting. Of course, Butch's horse doesn't look like he has any limits on him, from what I saw. And if they'll get the two turns comfortable, they're going to have him to beat in the Remsen, I think. And who knows where it goes from there. If the racing gods are shining on him, knock on wood and all that stuff, he looks to have limitless talent to me. He looks like a freak of nature. My filly is an awesome nice gal herself. I happen to be wandering around a winter mix sale a year and a half ago at Timonium. And just saw her, and I said, "Look at this straight-legged, pretty little thing. She doesn't belong in here." And I bought her for $12,000.
Unbelievable.
And it's a funny story. I was just drinking a cup of coffee, and Dan Ryan happened to call me up and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm buying your horse." And he said, "On a Sunday morning in the winter?" I said, "Sure, you never know where they are." And like I said, we got her for $12,000, brought her home. Raised her here on our farm in Unionville. We broke her here on the farm. We sent her in with the regular babies, and she's always shown talent, and now she's got a body to go with it. She's 16'2", probably weighs 1,100 pounds, big, pretty strong mare, and just doesn't do anything wrong. Her first race was a pretty tough race. It was one of those races where they had they doubled the pots, and it was an open race, and Tom Proctor and Sacco and everybody brought in some appear to be talented horses, and she just galloped away from them very impressively, which encouraged me to start her in the Blue Mountain, and she actually did the same sort of thing. John told me she was waiting on him to turn her home, so it was, it was a pretty impressive effort. So we're 2 for 2. She'll get a good test next time. We'll probably stretch her out just a hair and run her 7/8 in that little stake at the end of the year at Laurel, and then if she passes that test, we'll map out a plan for bigger and better things. But she's so far very talented. You know, big, strong filly, looks like she has a future to make.
Certainly. I mean, debuted 72 buyer, came back here with a 74, and, you know, has won by open lengths both times. I mean, 4-length winner in the stake and won by 8. And one thing that is interesting, I mean, just watching her, it doesn't look like she's got to have the lead either. It looks like if I mean, whether it's going to be Alex Cintron or whoever, it doesn't look like, you know, she's headstrong at all either, despite the fact that she's obviously super fast. 58-3 back in November, on November 4th, and then 35-4 in her final blowout for this race.
Yeah, she has extreme talent, but what makes me think and hope she'll go on to bigger and better things is she's got the mind for it. And you know, Steve, the mind's what it's all about. If they'll settle, and I knew I was actually afraid when we were saddling her for the steak Saturday night. She never picked her head up. I thought, boy, she's quiet, she's dull. But she really isn't. She just exudes class. And really, I would be very surprised and disappointed if this filly doesn't go on and you hear from her later on a national level. I really think that she has a whole lot more to give and has not been extended in any way. I just think she's going to get better and better, and I think she will stretch because of her temperament. I don't see going around two turns, stopping her. She, like you said, in her first race, she sat behind a speed horse just as patient as you can, ask one. And Jock took her cross, and she, took that as her cue and took off. So, I have a lot of hope for this filly. I think she's okay. So far, so good.
And the other thing about this that in terms of stretch out, when you look at the female family, she's out of a flatter mare, and the flatter mare herself, just a one winner. But as it happens, she's a half to a horse that I remember in New York. In fact, a good friend owned, was a part of the ownership group of I'm Bluffing, the Pine Bluff gelding, the Bluff Man. And he was a big two-turn horse. And their dam, their respective dam, was bi-affirmed. So there's plenty of stamina in the female family. And, of course, Munnings is Munnings is money. He just gets all kinds.
He gets every kind of horse. Yeah, that's exactly the way I look at it. She's a big, tall, framed, two-turn-looking horse. She has the right mind, and like you say, there's enough depth in that pedigree that, there's reason to believe that she'll make two turns. I really think she will.
Well, that's good enough for me. And when I saw this on the was it Wednesday night before Thanksgiving?
Wednesday night, yes.
Yeah, it in fact, this was the Pennsylvania bred of the three stakes, the Swatara and the Fabulous Strike. But Pennsylvania bred swept the obviously a Pennsylvania bred is going to win this race. But then Pennsylvania bred's also won the open stakes as well. So it was a good night on that front. So we'll see her at Laurel before the year is out. And then what are you doing this winter? What's your plan going forward in terms of, coming out of the Mid-Atlantic, and or are you gonna spend the winter in the East?
Actually, I spent it where I spent last winter, at Pimlico.
Nice.
We are based at Pimlico. Just because I happen to think that the Pimlico racing surface is as good as any on the East Coast. And although it's a little bit of a drive from my home here in Unionville, I like it in that you have everything a racetrack normally has, but not so many horses. And it's quiet, and it's really, really a good place, I think, to train a horse. So I'm going to stay right here.
Nice.
I think last year we missed 2 days of training all winter, 3 days, something like that, which is okay with me.
How many barns are filled at Pimlico?
I'm going to say six or eight. There's probably 400 or 500 horses there. I'm going to say maybe it's probably half full. Which is ideal for me. The quieter,
yeah,
the better. The horses respond well. We have a free shuttle to race at Laurel. We're close enough to Penn and Philly, and occasionally to Aqueduct. So, I like the location. And it's just, it just happened to work for me. Dan's from Maryland, so he can get over and see some of the races. And it's been good for me. Because my days of traveling around are kind of done with.
you make me think to ask, putting a staff together and finding an assistant and foreman and grooms, putting the band back together. How difficult was that?
That was extremely difficult. That was the most difficult. I started getting back in a couple of years ago, and I couldn't get it started because, the fact that the help today was not like the help on, there were a lot more young people, aggressive people. You know, I had the good fortune, John Service served as my assistant, of course, my brother Butch, and I had top quality people when I left 15 years ago, and it just, that was the most difficult piece, but I've kind of gradually got it to where I want it now. I have a great staff, I think that we're going to be fine now. Like I said, it took me probably 2.5 years, which it didn't back in the day. Everybody, there was a lot more eagerness to go to the backside. But over the last 2 years, I've been able to build up a really, really good crew. And I think we'll be fine.
Well, to be able to reach out to you and congratulate you on this stake win and this filly, Please Flatter Me, who clearly is going places, and Easy to Flatter, Mark Reed, who I thought that both you and Butchie, I just it's always for me, Mark, when I've had a chance to congratulate Butch and Ginny. There aren't nicer people anywhere in this game than the Reed family, and every success you guys have should be hailed by everybody around the game.
I really appreciate those kind words, Steve. I really do. We've been doing this all our lives, and that guys like you notice it. It makes it worthwhile to me. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Mark Reed, everybody. And you can root along, Please Flatter Me, for Mark, and Maximus Mischief for Butchie coming up Saturday in the Remsen. Mark, Merry Christmas, and we'll see you down the road and see you about talking soon. I hope I'm calling you on a regular basis.
I like that. I hope so, too. Have a happy holiday, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks. Mark Reed, everybody, and Please Flatter Me. And if you haven't seen the replay, pull it up. I mean, this is a really nice filly. And I'm going to, I've had this picture, and I got to get Mark and Angel to sign it, actually, my mister. And that's why I haven't framed it up, because I've carried it to the track with me before, and especially when I'm in New York for Belmont week, and I got to get Angel to autograph this, and I got to figure out before which of Mr. Nickerson's wins this was, and I'm going to guess it's the Bold Ruler. That was a long time coming, that visit. Mark Reed, everybody. Let's take a break. Pat Cummings is going to come in here, and he's going to school you. Pat got to teach. Tina and I have Tina's a school teacher, so whenever Tina lectures me, my line is, Tina got to teach. Well, Pat's going to teach us about the category of stewarding and the approach that the international jurisdictions pretty much utilize, and the difference between North America's approach on this and what could be alleviated in terms of bugaboos if North America were to adopt Category 1 stewarding. Pat Cummings from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. Next, racingthinktank.com. I'll send out a link to the white paper that they offered last week, about 10 days ago. And they've been a steady, sending up flares and trial balloons and discussion points to try to prompt some positive change around the game. Back after this, Pat Cummings.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
There's more good news about Pennsylvania's breeding program. Last year, the number of state-bred live foals rose by nearly 30%. Many other states saw a drop of between 10 and 20%. This says that Pennsylvania truly has North America's fastest-growing and most lucrative breeding program. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
My baby, don't stand no cheating, my baby. Oh, yeah, she don't stand no cheating, my baby. Oh, yeah, she don't stand no cheating. She don't stand none of that midnight creeping, my baby. True little baby, my baby.
We're back.
My baby, I know she'd love me, my baby.
Little Walter, if you've never heard My Babe. Happy to get Pat Cummings back for another Thoroughbred Idea Foundation conversation. And it's very timely because about 10 days ago, give or take, the release of a second white paper, of course, the first one, and we talked about it, the concept of addressing breakage industry-wide and positively impacting churn through elimination of breakage, or at least the modernization of an approach. And approach is the topic here as well regarding stewards' decision-making and the set of rules, the set of parameters when it comes to inquiries and fouls and the various elements of such. And the international approach, which of course Pat is very familiar with from following Dubai closely and then the years in Hong Kong. And it just so happens that this is a perfect time to discuss it after some, you know, clear frustration over Friday's nightcap DQ, double DQ. Certainly one horse deserved to come down without a doubt. And the horse that crossed the wire first, Presidential Tweet, much more uncertain about the decision there. So with that as a backdrop, Pat Cummings joins us. Good morning. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you. And you certainly the same. It was nice to be back and experiencing Thanksgiving because I know last year on Thanksgiving in Hong Kong, I sat at a Chinese banquet at a single table for 28. So it was a little different this year, and much welcome, I can assure you of that.
Nice. And what kind of group, where were you for Thursday?
Went back in Philly.
Nice.
Flew back up and was with family and cousins. And, you know, you only get so many, I guess you realize. And having missed the last three, it was certainly nice to enjoy it. Of course, you know, you can have Thanksgiving in Hong Kong. They just call it Thursday. So it was definitely nice to be back home and with the family. And to be honest, I mean, it's my favorite holiday. And I would say of my 3 years out of the U.S., it was probably the toughest part of being away was missing Thanksgiving. So it was great to be back.
The scrapple in the stuffing? Does Mom use scrapple?
There was not scrapple in the stuffing, but there was scrapple had on the visit home at the good old dining car on Frankfurt Avenue there in Northeast Philly. I can assure you that the scrapple was enjoyed.
As it has to be.
As it has to be, 100%.
I love it. And those of you that are saying, what's scrapple? Look it up. Look it up. You'll get a real kick.
It's far better than it sounds.
Exactly. Exactly right. Well, perhaps category one rule over wrap is might be better than it sounds for our situation. Pat, talk about what the backdrop is for the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, even bringing this topic up and what went into it. You and I discussed this previously, so maybe 3 or 4 years ago. We had a Category 1 rule discussion, and you were advocating it then.
Yeah, it's one of those things that really, I think we were reacting, you know, the first white paper came out just after the end of the summer meetings, Del Mar and Saratoga, and the timing of it, I think, worked pretty well. This had been an idea that we had been kicking around in the summer, but there were, I mean, I'd say we were really spurred on by a couple pieces that referenced the frustration amongst players, most notably, and what happened at Saratoga this summer, and the belief that the stewards were involved in a lot more races, which is true, that there were a lot more takedowns, which is true, and the reality is that there is an alternative. There is another way to look at this, and what we decided to do was really investigate the history of rules in North American racing, look at the alternative, look at what we're doing now, see what the alternative is, and if there is maybe a way forward that can yield an improved experience for all of racing stakeholders, because the results touch just about everybody. It touches breeding, it touches black type, it touches certainly the players, the fans, the general public who might tune into one or two races a year. It really reaches out to everybody, and lots of people have opinions, and it certainly felt amongst certainly some racing insiders that there was some frustration coming out of Saratoga, and, you know, for good measure. This year, there were 13 horses demoted over the course of the Saratoga meet. Last year, there were 6. Okay, so there was, you know, that feeling was a well-founded one. So we looked into it, and it really started with kind of an assessment of the rules themselves. And there have been various stories written over the years. Matt Hegarty's gone into it with Pollock. A whole bunch of people have certainly touched the topic of the rules themselves on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. And it's really a bit of a hodgepodge, Steve. There is, from state to state, there are slightly different rules, different wording. And what we've realized quite quickly is that the rules as they exist in North America under a category or a philosophy that's known as Category 2. They allow for a tremendous amount of steward's subjectivity, for a great deal of interpretation. And I'll give you an example of that. Just looking, you know, based on the food that was had in at Churchill, the double DQ the other day, the rules in Kentucky permit that if a horse swerves or is ridden to either side so as to interfere with, intimidate, or impede any other horse or jockey, this action shall be deemed a foul. The steward then can, or may, I guess the key word is may, make a decision to penalize and demote that horse, disqualify that horse, if they believe a foul altered the finish of a race. Now you go to New York, the wording's a little different. California, the wording's a little different. But the point is, the stewards are given an incredibly subjective power to really interpret on their own if they think that foul has altered the finish of the race. In some states, did it cost the horse a better place? In California, it's did it cost the horse the opportunity for a better placing? And it requires the stewards to really be very creative in their thought and say, you know, if this horse was an eighth and it could have been seventh, is that the opportunity for a better? Yes, okay, then that's a demotion. So that's just kind of in the abstract what we were looking at, that these rules are incredibly subjective. And then we just looked at the numbers, and it was most easy to get the numbers out of New York, California, because of the reporting and how the reports are published by each of those states. It was very straightforward. And found that California has an incredibly litigious racing product. Despite running 200 fewer races in 2017 than were run in New York, basically twice as many horses that were demoted from some position. Almost 2% of races in Southern California had a horse that was demoted, whereas in New York, that number was less than 1%. Almost 5% of races in Southern California had an inquiry of some sort of reviewed incident. And we see it time and time again. You can pick your race. It doesn't matter. Some horse players feel more aggrieved than others at certain times, depending upon the result. But there is this budding, and you know, it's a growing confusion, frustration, belief that there is inconsistency across these different jurisdictions within the U.S. And I would suggest that just based on the statistics themselves of what we've seen from New York and Southern California as outlined in the report, that's a fact. That is an undeniable fact that one track that has raced basically 10% less than New York has twice as many demotions. And, of course, we know that players are playing New York, they're playing California, they're playing across all these jurisdictions, and they are engaged in these markets. Owners are racing horses across jurisdiction. This yields a frustrating experience. It's a confidence zapping experience when what is it take down in one jurisdiction isn't in another, or vice versa. And we wanted to present an alternative that we think can improve the sport, can yield a much more consistent experience. That's really what it's about. It's about finding, is there an alternative? Can we make this sport better? And after doing the research, I think our position is certainly yes, there is an alternative. So the breakdown in the rules is what we determined, or what is identified as Category 1 versus Category 2. So in North America, every jurisdiction in North America, U.S. and Canada, is considered a Category 2 jurisdiction. And those jurisdictions are those in which, if a horse was cost a better placing, the interfering horse is placed behind the sufferer of the interference. Okay. The alternative is now in place in every jurisdiction on the planet except in North America. And that's known as Category 1. Category 1 states that had the interference not occurred, well, irrespective of the incident, the horse that suffers the interference would not have finished ahead of the horse that caused the interference. If that is the case, then the placings remain unaltered. If the stewards were to believe that had the interference not occurred, that horse would have finished in front of the horse to be interfering, then the placings can be changed. The burden, the proof that the stewards need is much different in Category 1. It yields far fewer disqualifications, or what we really would prefer to be called demotions. So horses that win by open space, two lengths, three lengths, four lengths, or are in the placings two, three, or four lengths ahead of a horse that it may have interfered with at some point in the race, those horses almost never are demoted under the Category 1 philosophy, because the stewards would find it very difficult to believe that a two, three, four, five-length winner would have, with some degree of certainty, finished in front of a horse that was that far in front. And in Category 1, and the numbers that we've published from jurisdictions that have recently made the change from Category 2 to Category 1 suggest that the number of horses that get taken down drop dramatically. So what we are espousing here is a philosophy where the best horse is typically the one that will still, hold on to a position. There is no perfect alternative. There is no absolutely equitable choice. And I've seen the arguments on both sides. We've certainly had plenty of people engage with us and ask us about it. At the Arizona Symposium last year, the topic was up for discussion, and there were questions from the audience that were saying, this is outrageous. How could this even possibly be considered? You'll lose owners over this. It's a very short-sighted viewpoint. There is absolutely no outcome that is going to be completely equitable for every possible result. So it's a matter of finding the best alternative. And the Category 1 approach tends to protect horses who are better on the day. And we are certainly of the opinion, and the report at RacingThinkTank.com outlines this, that on balance, the Category 1 approach values clarity and consistency, reduces the need for subjectivity, and people understand when a foul is going to result in a takedown and when it's not. And that on balance, that is a better long-term approach for the sport. It's consistent, it's confidence building, and it takes away a lot of the uproar that we see, unfortunately, very frequently. And we certainly saw that as the case just this past weekend.
Obviously, there's plenty of potential follow-up directions to go, Pat. I'll ask this as a general reaction. How different, per se, would things necessarily be when you still are going to have, no matter what, you're going to have sets of stewards that come from different vantage points in the industry. There's going to be, you know, people that were, there'll be riders. There's people that have come from different other walks of racing life. There's people that are coming from the government side of things and are, you know, racing officials that make their way to the steward stand and, you know, get accredited and you know, start careers as stewards. So you still, no matter what, the umbrella is, you're still going to have people that are coming at decisions with different mindsets. And I guess the parameters might, the change in the parameters might provide, you know, a certain direction that limits frustrations, but yep. you're still going to have people that see things a certain way, and I think that you know still provides maybe we just should be happy if there's less incidents where people feel like either the wrong horse was allowed to win, a horse that wasn't ever going to win the race gets put up, and that seems to be what we're looking at from Friday, or that there may have been a technical foul, but it didn't necessarily affect the order of finish, and the horse that was clearly best, that horse players deserve to cash a ticket on, get victimized. And yep. Those are the two scenarios that drive players the craziest,
without question. Went in and pulled some of the dialogue. Scott Chaney from California and Eddie Arroyo from Illinois, and Illinois has been a kind of ground zero for controversial big race decisions over the years. Arlington Million, Beverly D, that meeting has been replete with rules and takedowns over the years. And I thought it was really telling how Eddie Arroyo, who's been there for years as the chief steward in Illinois, spoke about Category 1. And both he and Scott Chaney were introduced to the topic initially back at a meeting that was tied to the Pan American Conference held in 2015. They were introduced to it there, and I think both of them made it known that they thought, oh, this is never going to fly. And they were reintroduced to it in 2017, kind of a follow-up meeting to that. And what Eddie Arroyo said, and we quote this in the paper, he took it home to Illinois, and basically he and the stewards there, after whatever decision that they've made in a race at Arlington, or Hawthorne, really, they would then look at it after the fact if the rules were Category 1. And so they were judging the races day in and day out based on Category 2, but they at least stepped back and said, if the rules were different, if we were a Category 1 country, what would we have done in this case? And his response to this was, quote, "It made it so much simpler. We always would come to the same conclusion, and we'd come to the conclusion fast. The benefit of Category 1, and he says, and I'm not 100% sold on it, everyone understands what the stewards are going to do when the incident happens. And under Category 2, you don't know." And I thought that was telling. He said, it simplifies what we do. But at the same time, if we all did it, we would be really consistent, not just in our state, but across the country. It needs some discussion, but I think it has a future. And this is coming from the chief steward in a state that has probably taken down more horses in big races. And it's quite funny. They're oftentimes taking down European horses in those races, where the jockeys are typically riding more to their overseas standard than they are in America, and have fallen victim to it time and time again Powers Court, the Apache, Secret Gesture. Secret Gesture probably is the most notable of those, given that given how that went. And we've put the video up, but we've also put up the Powers Court video from the Million back in the early 2000s. And I thought that was very telling that, and this is kind of, I think, really one of the big takeaways, Steve, is that the stewards are interpreting a rule that allows them to be, requires them to be very subjective. And so it's tough to blame the stewards. They are humans interpreting a rule that allows them to be very interpretive, that requires a lot of interpretation. Whereas in Category 1, what they have to visualize, what they have to interpret, is much, much narrower. And a narrow rules interpretation, whether it be from the perspective of a fan, an owner, a trainer, a bettor, or a steward, if everyone's kind of on the same page and says, was that horse going to finish in front of the other one had that foul not occurred? If that's all we have to look at, then it becomes much clearer. And some people say, oh, well, that's not fair. You know, my horse was knocked out of a position to be in the tri or the super. And the response to that is, it isn't fair. There is no entirely equitable solution. But would you rather have days where sometimes you're going to get put up, sometimes you're not, and you don't know, and you get frustrated? Or would you rather have a clear and consistent approach? And the rest of the world, we're not talking about medication here. We're not talking about something that's maybe far more controversial in how the rest of the world does it. But we're talking about just how the rules of the race are applied. The rest of the world has said, this is a much better standard, Category 1. And right now we are sitting on an island here in North America as the only ones left that are applying this standard. So the I think that the impact is interesting to kind of project what it would look like otherwise. France and Germany made the change in 2018. And it's a little early to really look at the numbers, but the report out of France was that the number of inquiries were down by a third and the number of horses demoted was down by one half over this year. But the real story is Japan, because we have 5 years of history to review in what Japan has done since they made the change. Now, back in 2012, which was their last year under Category 2, they had 14 demotions out of 140 free inquiries. Since they have made the change to Category 1, in the 5 full years since that, they have not equaled either the number of inquiries or the number of demotions combined in the last 5 full years as they had in that last single year under Category 2. So that gives you an idea of how dramatic this change could be to yield a much more consistent and straightforward approach to the adjudication of the race. And that, at the end of the day, I think is what players are looking for. Now, there are some people who responded to us on Twitter, and you know, I look at the contest player, Tommy Massey, who says, never take a horse down. Just leave them all up. Maybe a little extreme, but Category 1 gets to a point where there are far fewer demotions, and you take care of jockeys with some greater focus on penalties, increased suspensions, particularly in big races, and you make changes in that sense.
The obvious follow-up to this, and we invite everybody, I just put up the link directly to the topic within the website. There's a couple of things that actually very timely. I'm going to ask you about RCI and about rope. And as it happens, ROPE, the Racing Officials Accreditation Program, they happen to be doing an interference survey that is being circulated, just 10 questions, and you can go through it, and it, you can provide an opinion and some feedback to ROPE. Pat, how, you know, how would RCI, the Racing Commissioners team and ROPE, how can they implement or at least you know, float out the Category 1 concept for evaluation, and you know, what would it take for everybody to adopt the Category 1 approach?
Well, I know it's being discussed, and there's definitely some interest among some folks within the organization of considering the impact of this change. And so we tended to view that our report would maybe be the first mainstream kind of taking it out of the hands of just kind of racing officials talking about it themselves and bringing it to a mainstream level and discussing the topic there. There is that survey. I'll go find it and tweet it again if it's still active.
It is.
Yeah, and you can actually see the results because they allow you to see the results at the end of it. And what I found was very interesting is they took four or five races where there are, you know, it might be tough to really determine, do you want to take this, if you were the steward, would you have taken this horse down and demoted the horse, or would you have left the result the same? And they got some very kind of variant responses, but the most significant response, I thought, was that the vast majority, I think it was over 80% of respondents, said whether it's domestic or international, we'd love to see just one standard rule. And that standard, knowing where everywhere else in the world has moved to a standard and we're still sticking here on our island, I think that's suggestive that a switch to Category 1 is more likely than not at some point in the future. Now, what would have to happen is the racing officials would likely have to, ROPE would likely have to suggest to the Model Rules Committee that they were supportive of a change. The Model Rules Committee would likely then have to adopt that and accept the model rule that is outlined by the IFHA, which has been adopted just about everywhere else, like I mentioned. And then the individual states could adopt it from there. And it is, in the paper, we've outlined that, you know, a much greater focus needs to be made on communication and communicating this change and how that change could happen. We have shown how it's been done in other jurisdictions. But that opens up another point, which is, and this is certainly some of how I was frustrated seeing the Churchill insinuations that were made by some over the weekend, that there's a conspiracy, that the stewards are looking at the will pays and determining that based on a decision of how it's going to help a particular track. I think that's nonsense. Okay. However, when stewards do not routinely face the media, when they are not out in front, when they are not known to the public, when they are not seen on camera, when they are not explaining decisions, when there are not very detailed reports on their decision-making, when that doesn't happen, when those details feel like they're kind of locked up in a booth high above the action with very little public observation, that yields people to get those conspiratorial views. There's no reason that we in America, whether it's Category 1 or Category 2, shouldn't be far more open, far more accessible to the decisions which are affecting the transfer of millions of dollars annually. Think of it this way. In no other professional sport is the final outcome of the event dictated by the decisions of the umpires, the referees. Okay, unless it's the last play of a game. Okay, in racing, that is what they do.
I'll take issue with that, frankly. I mean, that's incidental. That's just the adjudication. Where the adjudication happens then that's actually a separate topic in terms of how Category 1 might view things like incidents at the start of a race, where the stewards are going to, getting back to my one point about all of this is that, you know, the education and the experience of every individual steward, and John White will join us after Andy Serling, and John will talk as a licensed steward. John will address, he's listening, and he'll talk about, you know, his impressions. But, Pat, the final result of a game can be impacted greatly just by how the officials have called the game all through the course of it. So, I mean, just to say that, all right, we have our judges and our umpires, quote unquote, are there at the end to make things official, that's just incidental. That's just how our game is structured. It comparing it to other sports it's a apples and orange discussion.
I feel the same way, though, when many people have suggested about the central office, the central kind of review structure, and we outline this in the paper because the suggestion has been made many times that racing would be benefited by having a simple central review structure where one set of stewards is looking at all of the races. Similarly, I don't find that there is a comparative that there's a legitimate comparison that can be made between racing and, say, the way that baseball has a central office reviewing plays after the fact, or basketball or football. So there are many different ways in which we compare racing to other sports, and I agree with you that is not something that can be done, that there are many differences between them, and I don't think a central review structure would necessarily work, and we explain that in the paper, as to why. But no matter what, none of those review structures, none of these other sports are changing the result after the fact. Only in racing is that happening. So it does make us different, regardless, in the way in which our sport is officiated. And I just think it needs some degree of consideration.
Fair enough. That topic, I mean, I saw one comment last night on Twitter about the Friday circumstance at Churchill, saying, these kinds of things never put somebody up. And, of course, that's just preposterous.
It's just
an idiotic non sequitur, considering that you could go through virtually any pick six sequence or any major payoff. People do understand that there's DQs in leg A, leg B,
yeah,
leg C, leg D, leg E. Or they don't even have to be DQs. They can be non-calls that probably should have been calls. And so to think that, this never happens the other way is just idiotic. I mean, I've never heard anything. I've never read anything so stupid.
Yeah, it's... But again, that mindset is unfortunately, I think, bred by kind of the mystique that exists and the lack of, suggested transparency that the stewards aren't normally out in front being a regular part of kind of the public view of the race. And there are ways, again, Category 1 or 2, that I think that infrastructure could be dramatically improved. And I think it would help eliminate those types of views over time.
Well, and that would be an objective worth pursuing, no doubt. In fact, Andy Serling, who's joining us now here next, Andy made a really salient point about getting, having, and as you referenced too, getting the stewards to be potentially, more interactive in a lot of ways. I mean, and we've had this discussion with people like John White and with rope officials and with people like Tony Black. And, you know, the proactivity of the stewards, you know, the film patrol. I mean, there's so many other working parts of this, you know, where for years, you know, the stewards would have educational sit downs with jocks, particularly with young riders, and talk to them, you know, ask them, what were you doing here? What were you thinking? What, you know, why did you think you could do this? You know, that all of those portions of the equation that you know could have, you know, lasting impact in terms of the way a rider approaches the craft. I mean, that seems to have gone away. We don't necessarily address this kind of thing. And as you mentioned too, you know, having more communication going upstairs the way the pro sports are having retired or you know tangential people from the officials department explaining calls, helping the public understand the calls, you know, that all would go a long way. So there's a lot that can be accomplished here, and frankly, given RCI and rope and the whole model rules approach, this would not be difficult if there is a groundswell of support and there were the right majority that were convinced that this would be advantageous. It would not be hard to implement industry wide.
Yeah, and I appreciate the chance to talk about it. Feel free, anybody that's listening that wants to kind of engage more on Twitter, by all means, reach out and be happy to. Just with everyone keeping in mind, there is no perfectly fair solution. It's about finding the best kind of middle ground, and we're happy to talk about it, and just like everybody else, I think we want to present and get to a point where this sport is in the best position possible. Right now, we don't think that's the case. So there is an opportunity going forward, and thanks as always for the time, Steve.
Not at all, Pat. And we put up the
see
link.
See you in Arizona.
Absolutely. We'll see you on Monday at Tempe at Tucson, and we're on a committee, we're on a thing together, and you'll hear from Pat probably live with me at some point during the 3 days of coverage from University of Arizona and the Global Symposium on Racing. Let's take a break here. Go to the link I put up to racingthinktank.com, and specifically this report on changing the rules, and some really good video and discussion of specific incidents. And also, I'll put up the link to the Racing Officials Accreditation Program website and the incident, the interference survey that they're conducting, which is really cool. And you watch some races, and you have to make a call. And you have to explain, you know, why you decided one direction or another for a DQ or a non-DQ. It's helping. It'll help them. In fact, I can certainly get a rope conversation. We were doing rope conversations, and we haven't done them for a while. So that would be well worth having a follow-up on this topic. Let's take a break, a little less than an hour, to close out on what's been a swift Tuesday, and Andy Serling going to join us, and we'll touch on some of the results from the weekend. It was obviously a busy holiday weekend of racing with the Long Island and the Discovery and the Turf Sprint and the Comley, etc., and then the big Cigar Mile card. They'll draw tomorrow, and there's actually tomorrow the carryover sequence where you can expect those two races on the turf to come off tomorrow, the fourth race and the sixth. Back after this, Andy Serling and then John White at the races, Sirius XM.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line, 800-522-4700.
There's more good news about Pennsylvania's breeding program. Last year, the number of state-bred live foals rose by nearly 30%. Many other states saw a drop of between 10 and 20%. This says that Pennsylvania truly has North America's fastest-growing and most lucrative breeding program. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.